cross before his crucifixion, expressing his final desire on earth of what he would like as he brings God's will to earth as he has. John 17:24, Father, I desire that those also whom you have given me may be with me where I am, to see my glory which you have given me because you loved me before the foundations of the world. As the covenant comes to Sinai, Sinai being the crossroads where the children of Israel will be asked probably the most important decision they will make in our entire journey as we've been studying the covenant. But I would say that the desire for Jesus and his disciples is the same voice that the Father gives in the covenant itself. It's not a voice apart from the Father, Jesus' prayer to him. It's not a voice apart from the Father in the Spirit, but it's a triune declaration of what God has always desired from us. That is, his presence with us. The covenant has been the proof, hasn't it? The covenant has always been offered as a walking, talking, face-to-face proposition. He creates Adam and Eve and then comes to them, even finding them in the bushes, hiding them because they are now afraid. He makes his way through this world of fear and this misinformation, if you will, about the God of this covenant. He wanders the earth and finds Noah. And then he finds Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Jacob. And he offers all of them this covenant relationship. But the crossroads is coming. He's walked with them in a particular way. He's revealed himself to them in a particular way. And he's about to do it in something brand new to them, but not new to the one he found 40 years ago. Because then came Moses. Moses, in a way, is like every other patriarch, and in a way like none. Nothing like the other patriarchs. The children of Abraham, who were delivered the night of Passover, had been enslaved by a pagan power for over 400 years. The people who served these angry, made-up, bully gods every day would beat and starve and sap and steal the will of a people, of a promise that, my opinion, in what I read and what I gather, a promise they don't even remember. Do you think there's anybody in Israel up to 490 years of slavery who even remembers the promise of this God, of their father Abraham, if they remember their father Abraham at all? These are the people that this one man was asked to lead across the desert to the land that God promised that grandfather. And as they're leaving over their shoulder, they're remembering the plagues. They're remembering the horror of the plagues for days. And then came that Passover night where they escaped the death that came. And then the very next thing that happens is the Red Sea. I've bragged before that if I had witnessed the Red Sea, I never would have wavered in my faith ever, ever again. And I see some smiling. But it's easy to say, thousands of years later, never experiencing a day of slavery in my life, that's easy to say that one single miracle could do that. But I want you to be a little honest with yourselves as to the people that witnessed it, the people that were actually there. Again, after nearly 500 years of being brutally oppressed by a bully claiming to worship bully gods, so far, what has this God of Abraham shown them? That he could be just as big a one. He could be just as big a bully. Now, the bullying may come to their oppressors, so maybe it feels a little bit better than being bullied. After the Red Sea, they will sing and they will praise him overwhelmingly. But if you read the song of Moses at the Red Sea, it's all about gloating. I will sing unto the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider who's thrown into the sea. That's what the song is all about. He crushes. The Lord is a warrior. It's all contained in that song. Why? Because this is all they know. Yes, after the Red Sea, he'll provide water. He'll provide them bread. He'll provide them water again. In other words, nothing but signs and wonders and signs and wonders. Miracles that protect, feed, cure, and thirst. And we think we know what we would do and react to those signs. But we're not there, are we? I want you to just remember the words of Jesus real quick. He says, this faithless generation asks for a sign. But what sign would Jesus give them? Not the miracles they wanted, not the miracles they expected, not this divine power that was shown at the Red Sea. He said, I'll give you none of those. I'll give you only the sign of Jonah. I'll give you the sign of God exerting power over somebody. I'll give you the sign of God exerting all of his power under and actually dying, actually losing, actually not being like any of the bully gods you created. Signs and wonders as, like the plagues for the Egyptians, they do not convert. As a matter of fact, they may work against your faith. So they come to the foot of Sinai. This is the crossroads. This is it. This is why Moses was sent there 40 years, or met 40 years ago and sent there. In these verses, we'll come across this verse in our study today, but it said the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face as one speaks to a what? As one speaks to a friend. And then in chapter 3, after he introduced himself to this friend, he says, now go, I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. And I, he says, will be with you. Our friendship will be there. I'll be with you, and this will be the sign for you that it's I who sent you. When you brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God. Where? On this mountain. Right here, Moses. Bring them back to me. Bring them here. He asked his friend to bring all Abraham's children. This is the promise of Abraham, to bring them to the mountain so he could give them the opportunity that he gave all of their fathers and their grandfathers before. Bring them to the mountain so I can give them the same opportunity, Moses, that I gave you to be my what? To be my friend. Sinai is the crossroads. They'll be asked to decide something momentous about God, this God that Moses speaks of, that has taught them. This God that they've witnessed what he is capable of. The decision will be between the shofar and the shadow. My argument is, right now they live in the shadow because they haven't met him yet. Not face to face, not like Moses has. The shofar is the invitation to have that. Will Israel continue to live in the shadow, or will they listen to the shofar? So I'm going to study this part of the Exodus, probably not in the way that you want. I've already said all I'm going to say about the Red Sea and the care in the wilderness and everything. Because I want you to kind of put yourself in mind of them rather than for us to look back sitting from where we do at what happened. Because I guarantee you that my proclamation that if I had witnessed the Red Sea, I would never waver in my faith again. What am I doing? I'm so much better than Israel. I'm so much better than them. I can't believe how much better I am than them. And every time that we study, every time that we go back and look at stories that we know and that we've known ever since Cradle World, when the felt board was put up there, I guarantee if we're not completely, absolutely sanctified, every time we hear those stories, that's exactly how we feel. Amen? so much better than those faithless Israelites. How could they do this? My theory to tell you this is that signs and wonders will only get you so far. So the crossroads is here. What will they decide? It says Moses went up the mountain. Now, chapter 19 is a confusing chapter. So we're going to kind of go back and forth a little bit, put it in an order that we can see. But it's always been a confusing chapter to me. I always felt that I knew exactly what was going on here. And I found out sometime later that what is going on isn't really what was going on. And it's exactly the opposite. So hang in there with me. Moses went up the mountain and called him to him from the mountain. And he says, "You shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the Israelites." So who's he speaking to right now? He's only speaking to Moses. Israel is at the foot of the mountain. Moses has gone up and he says, "I want you to tell them this. You have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and how I brought you to myself. You witnessed my what? You witnessed my power, right? You witnessed it personally." And he's, "Now therefore, if you obey my voice, keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession out of all the peoples. Indeed, the whole earth is mine, but you shall be for me a priestly kingdom, a holy nation. This is what I want you to tell them." So far, who is he talking to? Moses. So far, who's the only one that tells the Israelites what God has said? Moses. So far, that's where we are. And when you read the rest of the chapter, it's very, like I said, it's confusing. He puts them through an elaborate preparation, all culminating in the third day. He says, "This is what I want you to do for 3 days. On the third day, something special is going to happen. But up until then, you need to do something." He tells them to wash their clothes, consecrate themselves. He says, "Put limits around the mountain. Don't approach, don't touch, don't defile." Now, defile is the opposite of sacred. So he's pronounced the mountain what? Sacred. And he doesn't want them near it. He's put a boundary around it. So what makes a mountain sacred? What makes any mountain sacred, if you will? What makes this mountain sacred? Well, next it says this. It says, "No hand shall touch them." When he said put up the boundaries, it's the verse before this. So when he said put up the boundaries, he said, "If you have an animal who wanders onto the mountain, don't go after him. Don't touch them. Shoot them." Okay? Stay back. Shoot them. So he says, "No hand shall touch them. They'll be stoned or shot with arrows, whether animal or human, but they shall not what? They shall not live." Is he serious about how sacred this mountain is? Look what he says next. And this is why it's so confusing. This half of the verse should be a separate verse. I'd like to meet the dude who put the verses on. We know who he was. Sometimes he got it right. Most of the time he got it wrong. He gets it wrong right here. Make this one a separate verse so we could understand it. But then I thought, no, it belongs exactly where it belongs. After all this, don't come up the mountain or what? Or die. After all this, he says, "When the trumpet sounds a long blast, what? They may come up the mountain." So what makes the mountain sacred? It's him. See, because right now, he's kind of above where they are. And you'll see what happens. He says, on the third day, something special is going to happen. You know what's going to happen? He's going to come down. And once he comes down, they get to what? They get to come up. And it's shocking, isn't it? I read this in devotion for years. I thought, well, you know, it's the sacredness of the mountain. Israel is not a sacred people. They're defiled. They don't have faith. They've been grumbling the whole time. You know? This is punishment for them. They'll never be able to. And I thought this was about God wanting to separate himself from all defilement. reason they're not supposed to come up now is because he isn't there. He doesn't want to worship him from afar. He doesn't want to take steps up the mountain and have him not be there. On the third day, they both come together. That's what he wants. He is not going to lord his holiness over the unholy. He's going to share his holiness with the unholy by inviting them into his holy presence, no matter how unholy they are. That's what they were supposed to hear when they heard the what? When they heard the trumpet. Yes, there is thunder. Yes, there is lightning. The shofar or the shadow. Now, y'all know what they chose, right? I'm not making any spoiler alerts, are you? We can skip that, just a little bit after the whole light show and everything else. It said when all the people witnessed the thunder and lightning and the sound of the trumpet. By the way, did they hear the trumpet? Yes. Okay. They definitely heard the trumpet. It wasn't because the thunder and the lightning were louder. In fact, knowing God, what of those three do you think was louder? I bet the trumpet was louder. But anyway, when they witnessed the thunder and the lightning and the sound of the trumpet, the decision, right? When they heard the sound of the trumpet, what were they supposed to do? Because he's down there now. He went down, brought all of his divinity with him. So of course the mountain quakes. Of course it thunders. Of course there's lightning. He's who? He's God. But now he is in the space. He is the sacred space. And the trumpet was supposed to get them to what? To come up. But they were what? They were afraid. And they trembled. Did what? They stood at a distance. Now, one thing that I left out, and I did it for time, because I think I'm going to be late today anyway, but between 1913, when they were told about the mountain, and now, at 2018, something happened in the middle. Does Exodus 20, verses 1 through 17 sound familiar to anybody? It's the what? It's the Ten Commandments. By the way, Moses hasn't been up the mountain to get them on the tablets. When do we hear the Ten Commandments for the very first time? Here, Exodus 20, 1 through 17. And by the way, he didn't write them down. He what? He spoke to them. He has been talking to them. He has been giving them the same voice that he's been giving Moses. They were not written first. They were spoken first. Why don't most people realize this? I have a theory. Because it's not in the movie. DeMille didn't do it that way in the movie. The first time you hear the Ten Commandments in the movie is when God writes them with his hand. Right? He spoke them first. Which says something about the tablets, by the way. That's why I called this series From the Word to the Stone to the Flesh. It says something about the stone. God spoke to them. This was it. This was the whole purpose of the Exodus. Right here, Moses, bring me all of Abraham's kids and grandkids. Bring all my children to me so I can what? So I can talk to them. The thunder, yes. The lightning, yes. But what are they missing? The trumpet. It's blowing at the same time. They hear it. And again, they were supposed to come together. Why? Because he did not want to lord his holiness over them. He wanted to invite their unholiness into his holiness. The trumpet was that sound. The shofar was that sound. By the way, shofar, Hebrew word for trumpet. I like the word shofar. It just hits me. The shofar sounded this invitation. Moses hears a familiar invite, but the people don't. Same trumpet, same voice. Moses hears one thing, they hear another, and they make their choice. When choosing between the shadow, living in the shadow apart from God, and living in the shofar's invitation, they choose what? They choose the shadow. Moses, you speak. They just told God to what? Shut up. You speak to us, and we will listen. But do not let God speak to us, because He is going to what? He's going to kill us. They really believe He's a what? They really believe He's a bully. That's what they've garnered from all the signs that He's shown them up until this point. And again, rather than try and judge them for what they believe, I would like to get into their shoes and imagine it for a minute. I'm just saying, if all they know about Him is His power, and that's all they've seen, then His voice is going to hit them a whole lot different than it hit Moses. You with me? Because what would the Egyptian gods do with this kind of power? Right now, in their mind, He's no different than who? He's no different than Ra. So everything that happens now will happen in two separate places. It will happen for Moses in the light, in the invitation of the shofar, and for the rest of all of Israel, it will happen in the shadows. Their entire relationship will be built on these shadows. See, when you pick an intercessor, when you pick a priest to go to God for you, you don't stand in the God in the light that God shines. You stand in the shadow of the intercessor. You with me? When Moses comes down the mountain and his light, he brings God's light with him, what do? They throw a blanket over him. They cover it up. But right now, they refuse to walk into the light. They want Moses to stand in the light for them, which means they will always be in the intercessor's shadow. An intercessory priesthood is a shadow of worship of the living God. And they're perfectly content with it. That shadow will be Moses. Moses will be the only one that will be face to face. See, it said, the people stood at the distance while Moses did what? While Moses draws near to the thick darkness where God was. It's amazing that the shadow is now dark to them. You know, they're back here. Moses walks into the darkness. Why? Because they're on the outside looking in. So even the light looks like what to them? It looks dark. And the Lord said to Moses, thus you shall say to the Israelites, you've seen for yourselves how I went. Spoke to you. Before he's going to do what he's about to do, before he does it, he wants to remind Israel that I was what? That I was speaking to you. I was inviting you to hear me. I was inviting you into my presence. I just want you to remember, before I'm about to do what I'm about to do, I want you to remember that I spoke to you. I gave you the same invitation that I gave Moses. I don't want an intercessor. I want you. For the next four chapters, God speaks to Moses in this thick darkness, and he allows Israel to listen. At most, an intercessor, a worship by intercessor, at most, you get to eavesdrop on the conversation. You don't get the conversation personally. They get to eavesdrop on Moses' relationship with God. Was that good enough for God? Is that what he wanted? By the way, the very first thing that he's about to do, the children spoke, Israel speaks, and God listens. So for the next four chapters at least, he's going to start with this intercessory relationship. And the first thing he does is tell Moses how to build an altar. That's the first thing he does. After these right here, the first thing he does will tell him how to build the altar. By the way, it is the first piece of priestly intercessory worship. Every temple has one. Every god has one. They all have a what? They all have an altar. It shows you what Israel wants. It shows you what God is willing to do for them. But let me ask you, before we go on, did God want this shadow between you and me? No. So he's giving the children what they asked for. It's not what he wants. He already gave them what he wanted. And they've what? They refused it. I'll no longer listen to the shofar. I'd rather live in the shadow. They hear God's words. They even promise to follow them. Remember? They hear the words and they say this. Moses went and told the people all the words of the Lord for these four chapters, all the ordinances that were given. All the people answered with one voice and said, all the words that the Lord has spoken, we will what? We will do. So they are going to try to obey without what? Without a relationship. They're going to try to obey as eavesdroppers, which means they will always, always believe that their worship is contingent on their what? On their obedience. And what happens when they don't? They say, we will do what we will do. We will obey every word. Why? Because they're afraid. Moses entered the cloud, went up on the mountain. Moses was on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. God says, I got more. Four chapters, that was just the beginning of giving them the intercessory relationship that they want. I've got more. Brings them up. 40 days, 40 nights. 40 days, 11 chapters describing this priesthood and this sacrificial system and how it will work. How the shadows will operate. How the people in the shadows will not get to participate in any of it. Out of all of Israel, there's going to be one, and it's not even a group of men. It's not going to be Levites and priests. It's only one man who's going to have this relationship that God wanted in the shadow. Not just any priest, but what? The high priest. He's the only one that will have the relationship that God originally wanted. I love that it is included in the tabernacle. Amen? But it's one versus every other believer. Remember what he told Moses to tell them at the very beginning? You bring them to me. They are my favorite people amongst all the nation because I want them to be a priestly nation. Which means every believer in Israel was supposed to be able to intercede for anyone else because they were in the presence of God. Some of the grandsons and granddaughters of these ancestors later on in the book of Acts are going to say the priesthood of all believers was ordained all the way back at Sinai. Everybody is an intercessor. Everybody is supposed to be one, a priest. But 40 days in 11 chapters to show how this is going to work. And after all that, Moses, finally, the Bible catches up with the movie. Right? After all that, Moses comes down the mountain. He's carrying something pretty special. What is it? God finished speaking with Moses on Mount Sinai. He gave him two tablets of the covenant, tablets of stone written with the finger of God. By the way, the mode of communication with the people that God wanted? No. What would God? God's already showed him what he would rather do. I'd rather talk to you, Myrna, than read about me on two tablets of stone. I want to talk to you. I want you to talk to me. I don't want you to just read about me. I don't want you to just read the tablets and wonder what I'm thinking. So, Israel, of course, after witnessing all this, after promising to do everything that he promised, everything, they're eagerly awaiting this revelation from the intercessor they chose. Are they eagerly awaiting his return? What does Moses find when he gets back? When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered around Aaron and said, come make what? Make gods for us. Who shall go before us? As for this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. Their intercessor is gone, which means their worship of the God that's still sitting up on Sinai, that's gone too. They have no choice but to what? Create other gods. Not only did Aaron say yes, Moses' brother say yes to making a mold, melting the gold God gave them from the plunder of the Egyptians into a golden calf. After the golden calf is made, not only did he do all that, he pops off and says, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." He built an altar to it. He burned sacrifices on it. And proclaimed the next day to be a feast day to their new God. By the way, he built that altar after God, Moses already told them how to build the altar. Aaron, maybe in his mind, still thinks he's what? Still thinks he's worshiping God? So Moses comes down, of course. First person he finds is who? Who's the one he left in charge? He asks his brother, "What's up with this, man?" Aaron says, "Oh, man, don't be so mad at me. You know how evil the people are. They asked me to make some gods." And he actually says this, "So I said to them, 'Whoever has gold, take it off.' They gave it to me. I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf." Left out to before Moses comes down to confront his people. God already told him what was happening, what was going on. And God threatened to wipe them out and make Moses a nation. Moses wouldn't hear of it, told God not to do it. You think after hearing Aaron say that, he regretted it just a little bit? Moses caught them all in the act. He asks, "Who is on God's side?" And all of a sudden, a bunch of dudes decided that they were on God's side. Who was it? The Levites. The Levites. They get up. He commands them to strap on swords and go do what? Go kill brother, friend, or neighbor. After all this is done, 3,000 end up dead. Dead by the sword. So what I always picture is, what does it feel like the next day? All of this that has happened. See, there is no other way out of this. Moses just strapped on. He sees no other way out of this. They all think there's only one way out of this. Somebody has to pay. God made Egypt pay. Of course, somebody has to pay. He's given this charge to us. Sin, righteousness, judgment. It doesn't just happen. Somebody's got to pay for this. 3,000 dead now. Yes, the calf is destroyed. In fact, Moses ground it up and put it in water and made it drink. Moses lost it just a little bit after that reply from his brother. But for those of you who wouldn't understand this, and I'm glad that you don't, can you imagine the hangover the next day? Just the hangover. Like I said, the altar's still there. Every memory of what happened the day and the night before, the days that they could have been doing this for days. And now they're standing ankle deep in their brother's blood. Just standing. Can you imagine what this is like? This is all they're left with. This is all. Moses says to them this. It's remarkable what he says. "Today you've been ordained for the service of the Lord, each one at the cost of a what? Of a son or a brother. So you've brought a blessing on yourselves this day." See, the way I read this after all that has happened, he's asking them, Is this a blessing? Do you think you've brought a blessing on yourself today? A whole day to ponder this, violence to death, and ask one question. What is the difference between the angry gods of Egypt demanding blood and the God that we just worshipped for days? This is what they're left with. Are you blessed, he says. By the way, your sin's still there, isn't it? The altar's right there, it's still smoldering. The sin is still there. 3,000 of your brothers are gone. You're standing in his blood. You murdered them. And God still sits where? Up there. He's still sitting on his throne. This is it. This is all we're left with. Commit 3,000 sins to cover up one. All who worship angry gods who need appeasing, this is all you're left with. All an intercessory relationship with God, in the end, this is all you're left with. When somebody sins, something has got to give. Somebody has to pay. Does it make everything right? That's what Moses is asking them. Is everything right now? Does it stand up to judgment? By the way, as bad as you're feeling, he's still sitting there up on the mountain. He still sits there. The one with the voice from 40 days before. They hear the same voice Moses heard. He spoke to them from the law. But when Moses heard it, he hid his face. He tried to bury it in the ground. He feared it so much. But that was 40 years ago. God invites him now to walk and talk. And when he does, he just heads up the mountain. Head held high. He did what he said he would do. He delivered them all the way to Exodus 32, all the way to the golden calf. And that's what I was saying about the plagues, about Passover, about the Red Sea, about all the miracles. Look what all of that did for them. It gets them to the same altar. They make the altar. That is all this signs and wonders relationship, the attribution and the fear of God. It gets them nowhere. 2 months it lasts at most before they are creating and worshiping other gods. All because they don't have what Moses had. They want a relationship. Without the relationship Moses has, they revert to idolatry like that. After the Red Sea, after the water, the bitter water made sweet, after the manna, after the water from the rock. And Moses, being the only one, is the only one to have this idea. And it's a crazy idea. It's absolutely crazy. The next day, Moses said to the people, "You sinned a great sin, but now I will go up to the Lord, and perhaps I can work. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." Moses is the only one predisposed, if you will, to try something else. Besides all they've done up until this point to try to do something about their sin. He's the only one that says, "You know what? Why don't we just ask?" Now, I'm not sure that Moses has that complete in mind. Because when he says this, "Perhaps I can atone for your sin," I think he thinks something that can't be done. But it's interesting what God does for you. So Moses returned, it says, to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people has sinned a great sin. They've made for themselves gods of gold. But now if you would only what? If you would only forgive their sin." All of them. He's the only one that says, "You know what? Maybe I could just ask him." But he says, "If you won't do it," which I think the way he words it doesn't think that he will. Because after that, he then offers himself as a what? As a sacrifice. "Blot me out. Blot me out of the book you have written." So the idea that if a good enough guy dies or pays the price, if a good enough guy does, then maybe that could happen. It's remarkable that Moses would ask this, but it's not quite yet what we think. But you can tell by God's answer what he is saying. God's answer next is this. He says, "But the Lord said to Moses, whoever sinned against me, I will blot out of what? I'll blot out of my book." In other words, you can't what? You can't atone for somebody else's sin. Sin is between me and who? And them. By the way, another statement about the intercessory relationship. An intercessor can go to God for you. You may be comfortable with that. But when it comes to sin, the intercessor can do what? Nothing. Because he's human too. So he tells Moses. It's almost like you say, you know what? I appreciate that, man. I know what you're thinking, but that's a dangerous thing to think. But now, do this. Go lead the people. Where? To the place about which I've spoken to you. See, my angel shall go in front of you. Nevertheless, when the day for punishment comes, I will punish them for their sin. There's a day coming, right? There's a day coming. But for now, do what? Lead them. Continue the Exodus. Continue the promise that I've made. Continue the covenant promise that I gave to your grandfather 1,000 years ago. After all this, after the entire nation worshiping a golden calf, he's still going to give them one. He's still going to give them the promise. Because there's at least one still listening to me. The Lord sent a plague on the people because they made the calf, the one that Aaron made. I included this because I didn't want you to think that I was selectively leaving things out. And yeah, it's horrible. How do I explain this? How do we do this with this God who loves? But he said, go leave this place, you people that I brought you up out of the land, and go to the land of the land I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and to your descendants, I will give it. You can't buy the forgiveness for their sin, Moses. It can't be bought. The plague, hang with me here. Isn't this exactly what an Egyptian god would do to a people who were so disobedient? In a way, God's still giving them what they want, what they asked for. The only reason that I think that it's different this time is because out of all the other plagues that are ever given in the Bible that were attributed to God, they all had casualty numbers. This one, there is no casualty number. You know why? Because he didn't want to try to teach them that it's eye for an eye. If he gives you numbers, then you would look and say, okay, it's 3,000 to none. Right? Because there is no human price to be paid for idolatry. Except for what? Except for death. Worshiping a God who cannot bring you life. So maybe a way to look at this is that even when he is justly provoked and dared to act like an angry, vengeful God, he refuses to it and gets down to business. He refuses to do it and says, go and what? Leave this place. Leave this place. Leave Sinai. The whole place is still what it is. I want you to get out. Go to where I told you I would go. Go to the land I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And he said, I'll send an angel for you. Get to the land. Enough of these people. Get to the reward. Certainly seems to deserve. And Moses seems to deserve. He's had to deal with these people. He would have taken it in a heartbeat. Right? I'm just asking you, if you were Moses, he just made this deal with you, what would you do? I'd take it in a heartbeat. Right? To be able to get the promise, to be able to be known as the one who brought you there, I'd take it in a heartbeat. But the problem is that he said, go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not. He says, I will not go up with or among you. I would consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people. It sounds like he's kind of what? He's kind of had it. He sounds like my dad on a car vacation. After 3 days, he says, I don't think I'm going to make it to the place with the rest of my family. for this? Now Moses puts this in here, and he goes, Moses said, this is what the Lord said, but remember what I told you before? He said, the Lord speaks to me what? Face to face, as one who speaks to a friend. Then he would return to the camp, but his young assistant Joshua, son of Nun, would not leave the tent. Moses said to the Lord, see, you said to me, bring me up this people, but you've not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you said, I know you by name, and you have found favor in my sight. Moses says, I don't want to go if you don't go. If I found favor in your sight, please show me your way so that I may know you and consider favor in your sight. Consider, too, that this nation is your people. He just gave him the deal of the century. By the way, if he would have taken this deal back to the people, what would they have said? Fine. You know why? Because when they leave Sinai, they're not taking anything with them. Their relationship with God will be smoldering on that altar. They don't have a relationship with God. They have no attachment to Him. By the way, they're not real thrilled with Him anyway. So if Moses tells the people, we get to go to the land that He promised Abraham, but He's not coming with us, the people would all go, great, I didn't like Him anyway. But Moses says, no, if you don't go, so God says, my way, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. Are you kidding me? That's one of the most remarkable conversations I've ever heard. By the way, Moses doesn't believe it. He asks him again, if your presence will not go, do not bring us up from here. Maybe he didn't hear me. Moses says, maybe he didn't get it. For how shall it be known that I found favor in your sight, I and your people, unless you go with us? In this way, we shall be distinct, and I and your people, and every people from the face of the earth. The Lord said to Moses, I will also do this thing that you have asked, for you found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. For the second time, Moses said, I will go with you. By the way, you remember a few chapters ago, I agreed to make myself portable. All right, in that little ice chest, in the smallest room of the tabernacle, all right in there, I agreed to make myself portable for you. And what's amazing is that after all this, this is finally when Moses says this. Please, one. I've asked for it, but it's not what. It's not enough. I want to see what? I want to see you. I want to see all of you. We all know what God told him. Not yet. Can't. Just now. My glory has not manifested itself in the time of history. It's coming, Moses. It's coming. And one day you will see it. But for now, I'll give you a little bit more. The cleft of the rock and everything else. But what I want you to notice too is that tied up in this request for Moses to see his glory, God does not forget him. He doesn't forget the people. They want him as their what? As their intercessor. So he is reminding Moses and reminding the people that this request for glory includes them too. But for now, I'm going to give you what you think you asked for. Two brand new what? Two brand new talents. By the way, we're going to get to what happens to these tablets and how God feels about them a little bit later. But he says, cut two tablets of stone like the former ones. I'll write on them. He's not going to have Moses write on them. I'll write on them again the words which were on the former tablets that you broke. All right, he says. God atones for our broken covenant with him, even if we want the covenant to be in stone and he wants it to be in flesh. Only God can do this. The only sacrifice acceptable will be in thousands of years later when he will send his only son. That's why he told Moses, you can't see it all today. Because it hasn't been manifested yet. God said, my glory is not manifested until Jesus comes, dies, and is resurrected. Then my glory is manifested. You won't see anything more to be revealed to you than that. If you have seen me, you have seen the Father. The only acceptable sacrifice is coming later. There's no bridge to life anywhere else. I'll wrap this up. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with them there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. If the vowels are right, we don't know. But what he did was he stood beside him and he pronounces the name Yahweh. Remember when Moses first met him, he tried to treat him like an Egyptian god. Remember, he was afraid of him, so he tried to trick him. He asked him his name. Priests knew the god's name, so claimed they had control over their god. Right? And he told Moses, if they ask you your name, he said, look, I don't play those games. I don't have that name. I am. You just tell them I am. I'll not be treated as one of those angry, vengeful gods with some priest's presumptuous trick looking to self-serve. Moses then walks with this man for 40 years, talks to him face to face, treats God like a friend, allows God to treat him like a friend, and then he finally does what? He tells him his name. It's because Moses isn't trying to play him anymore. Moses isn't trying to have an Egyptian God relationship with him anymore. God says, I trust you. I only give it to you because I'm your friend. When they became friends, God told him his name. Everyone else who refused this relationship misunderstood it. Anybody living in the shadows will always misunderstand God. They fear him. They believe the lies that are told about him. They'll keep him at a distance and then plead and wonder where he is when they need him. Still afraid? Are we still living in the shadows? See, in the system of the priesthood and the sacrifice, this one priest will get the only relationship. So, whatever we hear about the sanctuary, from here on out, always remember this. The high priest is the only one that is living out the relationship that God actually wanted. You with me? Because we're going to talk about the sanctuary next week. Once a year, though, he'll come into the most holy place and utter that name that he just said. All on behalf of Israel. And by the way, that high priest, the one that's going to have the relationship, guess who is the first one to hold that office? Who shall bring Aaron and his sons to the entrance of the tent of meeting and wash them with water and put on Aaron the sacred vessels? Shall anoint him and consecrate him so that he may serve me as one. He takes the golden calf of the priest and he makes it his. If Aaron has nothing to fear, by the way, should we? What do we have to fear? Why do we continue to live in the shadows? Not come to something, the author of Hebrews said, that can be touched, a blazing fire, and darkness, and gloom, and tempest. And the sound of the trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that not another word be spoken to them. But you have come to Mount Zion, and to the city of God, the city of the living God, and in heaven, the heavenly Jerusalem, to innumerable angels and festal gathering, to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made one perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. The only man, the only human, the only son of man who has a face-to-face relationship. relationship with God. The only one who would accept the invitation of the shofar and come out of the shadows and up the mountain is the only one, or the first one, that has a concept of Jesus saying, look, I don't need to go to the Father and try to convince him to like you. It's because he already loves you. He already invited you. You're the ones living in the shadows, he tells us. By the way, they won't get it. For the next 3,000 years, they'll believe that God listened to them only because a good man interceded for them. They will take Moses and they will make him nearly a god. But the real power is in a God who will do something loving for someone just because they asked. Recognizing their inability to do anything about their sin, and to come to the only one who has the power to do something. The shofar or the shadows. That was their crossroads. Yes, they chose the wrong road. But by the way, every believer, I believe, ever since then, all the way up to you and me, we've all been down this wrong crossroad. We've all existed in the shadows in some way or another. So that's how I always end our covenant series with a series for the next couple of Sabbaths. I want to talk about the shadows. I want to show you what these shadows are, what the implications are, what the results are of trying to have a relationship with God, but to do it through the shadows and still ignore the shofar. That's how we'll end it. I want to look at the shadows. Sinai was their crossroads. Sinai is our crossroads. Sinai is our crossroads every day. Every day, we're tempted and we're allured into the what? We're allured into the shadows. But while everything is going on and all the noise and all the what's happening around the world, if you listen real close, I don't think you have to listen that close at all, we hear what? We hear the shofar. And they hear the sound of the trumpet. You and I